morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tomorrow is Christmas 2020, almost exactly a year since the coronavirus invaded the human world. I hope whoever is listening to today's program is being sensible enough to help celebrate the first mass virtual Christmas ever. Perhaps soon the season will be telepathic. Today I read a couple of seasonal heresies I have written and occasionally recite on this program, my Christmas carols, and a few poems, my kids. I start with, "Come All Ye Faithful." And as I said, it's something I've written. Christmas, that pagan holiday appropriated from the followers of Odin, is a time for feast and fellowship, a convivial warmth against the cold winter ahead. It is a parochial celebration that affirms a civic Christianity as the national religion, although the nation is the uneasy host for every conceivable form of theology. Usually, the public piety is casual, indifferently observed, but occasionally the Puritan past clamors for power, generally during periods of disruption and confusion, such as the present, when theological ideologies imprint a grim, intolerant, and despotic orthodoxy upon constitutional law. It might yet be difficult to accept willful ignorance and evangelical vengeance as the center of political direction and intellectual discourse. But the anguish that underlies American culture is a schizophrenia unable to resolve material greed with spiritual piety. The political tolerance for a variety of religions that is assured in the nation's laws is probably due more to an awareness that no one sect has been powerful enough to rule over the others. And just to be sure, religion is not allowed to directly interfere with government except as inspiration and manifest destiny. The practical consequence of separation of church and state has been to protect each from the other. By its own law, the government cannot and should not enforce or impose any manner of worship or religion upon its citizens or any others who live in this country. It cannot attempt to regulate or interfere with religion or with anyone's choice of worship or choice not to. The current debate about church and state is less about religion than it is a dichotomy of political values between those who would impose a narrow doctrine of absolutes that are not to be questioned or resisted, only obeyed, and those who believe that everyone has the right and obligation to choose their own beliefs about what is right and wrong. If the United States adopted or was forced to accept a single religion distinct from a loosely defined public creed, other religions would be purged, in particular those that are not Christian. Races other than white would lose all of their already minimal civil rights. Women would be shoved back into second-class status, and most democratic freedoms would soon be suspended. The course of the current intrusion into politics by the religious right is less to glorify God than to manipulate religion as a conduit to political power and conversion of the government into a militant theocracy. If the religious conservatives who are clamoring for absolute control of the government succeed in changing the nation into an ecclesiastical state, the result would be perpetual inquisition and religious war. As precarious and brief as has been the history of political liberty, its only real opponent is the people's belief in a divine deity and their fear they might be immortal. Religion serves as handmaiden to political rule. From the beginning of history, humanity has evolved religions to explain life and its possible place within it, and always there has been the desire that life not end at the crypt. Religion has thus been a political instrument in every society, at once a source of philosophical inquiry and a political doctrine of identity and rule. By the very nature of the fear that produced it, religion is authoritarian and exacts servitude from its followers. The hope for life after life has served secular government. The misery of life can be borne steadfastly and in service to life's oppressors by the promise of rewards beyond earthly life, which is not necessary to prove. The dilemma of where we rank in the cosmos has been narrowed considerably to serve the ambitions of a very few who, paradoxically, seem to reap all earthly rewards for the pious suppression of their followers and subjects. It is double-edged. The use of religion for purposes of rule makes it essential to both regulate religion and inflict its doctrines upon government. The state supplants God, but belief in God is necessary to support the state. Nationalism is itself a virulent form of religion, but its major disadvantage is that it cannot promise life after death. Great masses of citizens believe that the nation is an extension of divine rule, however, or is an acceptable substitute. They proclaim the same fervor toward a flag as towards a deity, and often confuse them. American religious conservatives used to think the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, righteously denounced as the evil empire, was the classical final confrontation between good and evil, and would, through the use of nuclear weapons, result in the end of Earth. Now they find other apocalyptic struggles between God, anti-God, once again crusading against Islam, reminiscent of the advent of the first millennium, while simultaneously focusing culturally inward at gay people, assertive women, and third world immigrants who transport alien gods to these shores. The Christian conservative backlash is not simply the perception of the disintegration of society as the result of the deterioration of spiritual values, but what they also perceive as a war against religion by secular government, which in reality generally accommodates religious beliefs unless arguments against them are compelling. Religious fundamentalists are rarely accommodating, but instead exhibit malevolent contempt for dissent and refuse to accept that people who think differently might be sincere and even noble in their points of view. True believers put a rather low priority on mortal life, which is only a process of mortification and putrescence to the fervently faithful. They profess a distaste for life and its pleasures and pains. They despise what is known as humanism, which is simply an ethical and compassionate responsibility for being human, but which is reviled as permissive heresy. They believe that all who claim to be Christian must support every activity that fulfills biblical prophecy, even if it destroys the rest of us. This, of course, would be the desired Armageddon and selection of souls, the so-called rapture. Good and evil would both be destroyed with the end of earth, but good would return with the reappearance of Jesus Christ. Earth would be resurrected and repopulated with the souls of the faithful, who would dwell for eternity in the joy they eschewed in life. Everyone would have to die first, and everything Homo civilis has spent millennia to construct. It is ironic that the most grim, unbending, intolerant, and ignorant are unshakably certain that only they are beloved by God. It is perhaps more ironic that one would have to willfully participate in the murder of all life to be worthy of living forever. Most religions are preoccupied with death, with shades and shadows, and with few exceptions they share apocalyptic visions of the end of earth. A wonderful yearning of spirit and intellect is distorted into oppressive sets of scriptures that stifle the inquiry that originated religions. Questions are bent into rigid answers that must not be questioned. All religions demand their followers suspend the progress of knowledge, and that nothing pertaining to theological doctrine be advanced beyond the period in which a particular religion was founded. mythologies developed hundreds or thousands of years ago are taught as absolute certainties, and subsequent learning is dismissed as heretical. A distinction must be made between religion and spirituality. An atheist can be profoundly spiritual, while a religious follower might only be so because of social pressures, ambition, or as a result of fear, which is a greater draw to the pew than the boilerplated love of God. One does not have to prostrate before a disinterested deity to be moral. Morality is a conscience of humanistic behavior. In that sense, most religions have seldom acted morally. And in this millennial era of religious fervor, the political intent of religion is immoral. The issue of church and state is much more serious than the tiresome ambitions and subversions of zealots and despots. Separation of church and state embodies all other disputes, ethnic, religious, racial, and gender, which have resulted in civil wars elsewhere in the world, but are so far contained within the normal but very strained framework of American politics. Yet the middle ground of civility and reasonability is disappearing. Comparable to the slavery issue, no matter how many compromises are erected to stall or slow the outbreak of civil war, the confrontation between religious or secular dominance of the government seems to inevitably await solution in suppression and corruption of the democratic process, and perhaps ultimately in internecine violence. Deep religious beliefs are at their core a very real human desire to exist in harmony without cant or hypocrisy. Religion, like music, has the power to bring us together despite our differences. But for most of history, it has been utilized to separate us and ensures that the majority of humanity is perpetually at war with itself. We live at a time when the incredible pace of knowledge might liberate us from idolatry and speciesite, but instead we use what we have learned to terrify and threaten ourselves with extinction, and as a consequence, retreat into psychopathic regression. We shield ourselves with fairy tales constructed during epochs when Earth was thought to be the center of everything but heaven and hell, and which we should have jettisoned with our historical adolescence. We seem unable to respond maturely to our diminished status in the universe, or to understand that our religions and gods do not adequately address the real situation of perishable life or the birth and death of stars far beyond our reach. We would destroy all that we have built and all we are rather than change ourselves into what we might be. That is the real tragedy of clinging to superstitions we have outgrown. That was Come All Ye Faithful, which, as I said, I have written, and I have also written the following. Born to be a rebel, what sort of person was this Jesus Christ? The claim is that a baby was born 2 millennia ago without benefit of sexual intercourse, which must have severely tried the faith of a father and perhaps greatly surprised the mother. No one is absolutely certain when the infant appeared in a stable among farm animals, his temporarily homeless parents, and Old Testament say, angels and other celestials. The baby was proclaimed the Son of God by 3 travelers known ever afterward as wise men, although in his lifetime none of the world's religions recognized him as blood or spiritual kin to any of the smorgasbord of deities of that period. He had no brothers or sisters who are known about. This is disputed, and he seems to have been encouraged in his own omnipotence, as only children often are. Not much is known about the child's early life until he reached 30. Like his father, or the earth person who seems to have resignedly accepted his paternal role, he became a carpenter. Only one incident of his childhood is chronicled. He is said to have thrown a few money changers out of a temple, which betrays an early example of his essential naivete. He emerged from obscurity when he was 30, and until his death 3 years later, he roamed around preaching radicalism, sedition, and revolution. He was unusually popular among the impoverished and discontented, attracting followers of homeless and unemployed, mentally unstable and physically disabled, sexually and politically deviant, and other assorted pariahs. He eventually came to the attention of authorities who were greatly concerned about his disruptive effect upon the lower classes. So were upper-level members of the clergy. A paid informer from his inner circle, called apostles, betrayed him, and he was executed after an inconclusive trial. His place in history and myth is principally as a religious figure. However, a significant number of scholars challenge that he was the son of any but a humble carpenter. They claim he was a political activist, specifically a labor organizer, in an era when workers had absolutely no political or personal rights or liberties. These revisionists refute that he was executed for religious preaching. As even contemporary times show, religious radicals, TV preachers, and cult founders can be tolerated within a society, while labor agitators are frequently imprisoned or murdered. His execution is often cited as evidence of this theory. He was crucified on a cross, a usual method for dispatching criminals and enemies of the state, replaced in later periods by the gibbet, guillotine, and electric chair. However, nails were driven into his hands and feet instead of suspending him by the customary rope bindings. The specific use of nails is proof enough, the revisionists insist, that he was arrested and executed for his brazen attempts to organize carpenters and others of the working class into what would later be known as a labor union, and that he had no intention of founding a religion. Some of his later followers, though adherents of him as Son of God, have acknowledged that he antagonized the law and order establishment of his day. They admit, in the words of a few, that he attacked, quote, the very roots of his society, and that he, quote, was a problem to his mother and to his entire generation, unquote. He was the most radical leader who ever lived, a 20th century disciple has written. Although the revolutionary nature of his preaching caused his execution, his later proselytes adapted the status quo to their creed, which ultimately became his most effective instrument of perpetuation. By structuring a theology on the claim that he was the Son of God, his successors enjoyed an advantage most temporal systems lack and religions benefit from. They did not have to deliver on their promises. Indeed, for two millennia, they have kept their flocks docile with extravagant suggestions of everlasting life beyond the desiccation of the flesh, which surpasses anything secular organizations can offer. And the sweetest part is they don't have to prove any of it. The first generations of his disciples eagerly martyred themselves, incidentally providing immensely popular food for circus animals and great entertainment for Roman fans. The farther west succeeding generations moved the center of their expanding religion, the increasingly lighter his skin and hair in evocation of his image, and his radical ardor was, even with a beard favored primarily by male barbarians, softened to a benign, implicitly feminine expression. He is called the Prince of Peace, yet in his name his followers have warred incessantly against peoples of differing beliefs. Heresy, the bombastic justification for ritual murder of non-believers. And against each other, as sects rise and claim themselves his only true disciples. In his name, genocide was waged against the original inhabitants of the Americas. And Europe was made a cemetery in the name of Reformation, 17 centuries after his death. In the most grotesque excess of theology, a bizarre, vengeful sect that confused him with grim ancient gods he displaced, almost succeeded in exterminating the religion of his parents, which had refused to accept him as a long-awaited Messiah 2,000 years earlier. His presence might be useful again, but not in the scenario of Armageddon or rapture. Some of his more fervent disciples yearned for. Nor would it help if he, or she, posed as a Messiah, Buddha, or Guru. Humanity, as it has so often before, could use a few good prophets, revolutionaries armed with visions instead of weapons and hatreds. Unfortunately, false prophets emerge in unsettled periods who create great mischief and misery, whose violent and vengeful ambitions obscure quantum visions of universal suffrage and prosperity. Perhaps it is time to re-examine his real message to humanity. Instead of a son of God predestined to die to defer humanity's responsibility for its sins of greed, rapacity, and butchery, we have an ordinary carpenter who, for reasons that have been lost due to his deification, felt compelled to fight the slavery and injustices of his era and attempted to raise up the poor and disenfranchised into a powerful force of revolution. If that is what he was, then he did not die to save our souls. He lived to make us free and was put to death for that heresy. And that was Born to be a Rebel, which I wrote. And now, I'm going to read a few short poems about peace, written by children and which have been inscribed on plaques that are apparently, quote, scattered all over the peace garden, unquote, among flowers near the California State Capitol in Sacramento. The poems have been collected and posted on the internet by an artist named Polly Castor, who says she works to amplify good wherever I find it, quote unquote. A thought. People that walk the earth have a heart inside. Put aside differences and join hands. When prayers and dreams are answered, only then will we all realize that world peace and harmony make us one. And that was by Brandy Smith, grade 5, Clayton B. Wire Elementary School, Sacramento, California. Symbols of world peace. The world is a sacred place, a place for people to be happy, kind, and nonviolent. Let these flowers be symbols of world peace. And that was by Rob Shearer, grade 6, St. Francis Elementary School, Sacramento, California. A great place. I close my eyes. I enter a wonderful place. I open my eyes. I see and hear cries and pain. I believe that one day my dream of a peaceful world will come. And that was written by Thuy An Duong, grade 6, Clayton B. Wire Elementary School, Sacramento, California. How peace begins. Peace begins with saying sorry. Peace begins with not hurting others. Peace begins with honest and trust. Peace begins with showing cooperation and respect. World peace begins with me. And that was by Haley Hall, grade 3, D.W. Babcock Elementary School, Sacramento, California. What is peace? Peace feels like a leaf falling on me. Peace makes me feel at home. Peace is my friend when I am lonely. Peace is a tree being saved from a chainsaw. Peace is not having violence in the world. And that was by Alex Nauman, grade 4, St. Michael's Episcopal Bay School, Carmichael, California. Peace. Peace feels like a friend comforting you when you are sad. Peace is a flower opening and the beauty is shared with everyone. Peace gives the ocean a color like no other. Peace is a song that brightens up your day. And that was by Chelsea Areola, grade 4, St. Michael's Episcopal Bay School, Carmichael, California. Peace. Peace is like freedom, rainbows and a dove. Give peace to all the land. Give peace to our earth. Love the world as you love your country. That's how to get peace. and that was by Natalia Lieber, grade 3, Clayton B. Weyer Elementary School, Sacramento, California. Peace in the garden. People playing freely in the park, enjoying the warmth of the sunshine, able to see beauty all around, children singing a joyful song, each of us loving one another. And that was by Mimi Dowdle, age 9, Sacramento, California. And the first letter of every line spells peace. Peace. Peace begins with helping a brother. Peace begins with stopping a fight. Peace begins with being polite. Peace begins with saying, I apologize. Peace begins with making a friend. World peace begins with me. And that was by Timothy Goronov, grade 3, D.W. Babcock Elementary School, Sacramento, California. Peace. Peace is the blanket that covers the world with happiness. Peace is what calms the children. Peace is what soothes the trees. Peace is what quietly sneaks through the door. Peace is what the world wants. And that was by Gabriel DeCillo, grade 3, Crocker Riverside Campfire, USA, Sacramento, California. Peace. Peace comes when people put aside their differences. Peace is the happiness and well-being of one person, or family, neighborhood, or city, or even the entire world. Harmony between two people, or nations, that's peace. And that was by Dylan Cann, grade 4, Sutterville Elementary School, Sacramento, California. Peace is many things. Peace is being quiet, caring for friends, and giving hugs and kisses. Peace is praying, loving, seeing animals sing, being patient, sleeping, writing, singing to nature, and watching swans swim. Peace is giving love to nature, giving joy to people, and planting flowers in the spring. And that was by Grace Horrocks, grade 2, Self-Realization Fellowship Sunday School, Pacific Palisades, California. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineered this program. Today would be the great American heretical journalist I.S. Stone's 115th birthday. He was born on this date in 1905 and died in 1989 at age 82. He once wrote, "To be a pariah is to be left alone to see things your own way, as truthfully as you can, not because you're brighter than anyone else, or your own truth so valuable, but because, like a painter or a writer or an artist, all you have to contribute is the purification of your own vision, and add that to the sum total of other visions. To be regarded as non-respectable, to be a pariah, to be an outsider, this is really the way to do it. To sit in your tub and not want anything. As soon as you want something, they've got you." And that was I.F. Stone. Santa Claus brought COVID vaccine in his sleigh this Christmas, but immunity is many months away. So Merry Maskus. Gift yourself and all you love by staying home and protecting everyone by protecting yourself. Life is the real Christmas gift. Merry Christmas and Happy Kwanzaa.